Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network. My name is Victor Monin, and I have the pleasure today of welcoming Professor Adam Nocek to talk about his latest book published in 2021, Molecular Capture, The Animation of Biology. Professor, thank you so much for being here. You teach the philosophy of technology as well as science and technology studies at Arizona State University. You're the founding director of ASU Center for Philosophical Technologies, as well as the editor of Techniques Journal. You also serve as an assistant clinical professor at the Creighton University School of Medicine, and you are also a faculty member at the University of Warsaw in Poland. So before we start discussing your book and delve into its proper material and questions, I would like to give you some time to share with us what led you to write such a book on molecular animation. And maybe my first very genuine question would be, what is molecular animation and how does a philosopher end up being interested in such a topic?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me. And that's a great question. And, you know, it's funny because I have a lot of colleagues in philosophy and sort of theoretical humanities who kind of ask very similar questions. They're like, what's going on and why are you interested in this thing called molecular animation? Molecular animation very basically is, I like to think of it as time-based data visualization. So think about, you know, any animation character and basically replace your animation character in your favorite cartoon with a macromolecule and cellular processes. That's obviously a very simplified or a very simple definition of what molecular animation is. But what really got me interested in it, I suppose, it started back in my early days when I was a graduate student, and and from the get-go, I was interested in, I guess, what could be called epistemic media. In other words, sort of technologies, specifically visual technologies that are really kind of essential for knowledge production in the biomolecular sciences. And I think when I first came across molecular animation, when I started getting interested in them was when I was presenting a paper on time-based molecular processes. And I think I was sort of incorporating work by Evelyn Fox Keller and Gregory Bateson and folks like that. And I remember at the time, my supervisor came up to me afterwards, and his name is, who also wrote a fantastic book, which also includes some stuff on molecular animation, but he's more interested in graphic design and biology. His name is Philip Thurtle. And he came up to me and said, why aren't you working on molecular animation? Have you seen what they're doing out there now? And I hadn't really. I guess I was familiar with some of the imaging tools that that were sort of popular at the time. And then I started really getting into them and thinking about them and was really sort of fascinated because on a very superficial level, I suppose they were allowing biologists to kind of feel their molecular worlds. They were and I think I write a little bit about this in the book, allowing biologists to sort of give form to meaningless data. And at that time, and especially when I was a sort of young graduate student, I wasn't quite sure if biologists were actually taking them seriously, and you know how they were circulating in labs or whether they were or not, and if it was more really just interesting, like speculative research for the philosopher of science. I mean, I quickly came to find out that they are very important for biomedical research. But at the time, I was just sort of fascinated in them as a sort of object, and almost thought about them as kind of like kind of science fictions in some way.
This is an aspect of the book that I really appreciated, is that it opened my sense also of curiosity about these images. And I ended up Googling and looking for so many of these videos and snapshots of all these molecular animations. And I think that really opened a very interesting world of objects and videos. And I think that's one of the aspects of the book that I particularly appreciated as well, is at least it introduces us to that kind of media. And I agree, they are fascinating. But at the same time, obviously, your book doesn't just stop at this fascination, right? It starts with this fascination. And you actually quote at the very beginning of the book, I think something you already touched upon a little bit while simply defining molecular animation. But you quote an animator and scientist called Gail McGill. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Who writes, quotes, that the very same tools that were used to animate a character like Shrek or Nemo are now being applied to set in motion protein domains and cellular processes, end quote. And I think what's particularly striking about this quote is that it establishes a very uncomfortable relation between fictional characters and biological entities, as well as between entertainment and the realm of science. And it instantly raises all sorts of questions about the scientific value of these animation, as well as about the constructive nature of any entities that are being studied by molecular biologists. So could you maybe comment on, there's a reason why you put this quote at the beginning. So could you comment maybe on how this quote helped you maybe frame some of the questions of your book and how you see these questions unfolding from it?
Yeah, I think that's it's an interesting, quote from McGill, precisely because it does sort of stage the problem so well, right? This is the Hollywoodization of the molecular biosciences. What I think is really, really important, for me working through this, because I'll just say this, that one of the things that the book does is hopefully tries to, and maybe my editor was a little frustrated at points because it was really me trying to work through a problem of how is it that we can actually think about these things as valuable to the scientific community, because they are. And I think that is the thing that McGill is trying to suggest, is that it's not simply, there's a very fairly simple way of thinking about why they might be valuable to sciences, and that it's, they're communication tools, right? They allow us to communicate, scientific, quote unquote, facts to wider audiences. We've gotten sort of familiar with this in the COVID era, right? The famous spiked proteins of the coronavirus are all too famous now, and there's plenty of molecular animations. And in fact, many of the molecular animations that I cite in the book, I got probably a month and a half after the outbreak of COVID. The views shot up by over 100,000 on each of them, like this, just because people became so fascinated about our ability to animate this sort of molecular world. So there's a sort of straightforward answer that, like, okay, look at these are valuable because they're communication tools. But then you look at, but that's not really what McGill is suggesting here. And then if you look at the sort of work that people like Janet Iwasa are doing at University of Utah, and there are a number of other molecular animators, that's not really what they're suggesting. What they're suggesting is that, and what they're doing with these animations is they're actually doing research with these animations, right? And then they sort of function in the laboratory setting as other technologies do, right? In the sort of post-genomic era, we got very comfortable in laboratories thinking about computer screens being as normal as microscopes. And now we can start thinking about animations and the animation of proteins as being as normal as seeing, you know, data sets on a computer screen. And so that to me was the sort of shift that was really interesting. And one of the reasons that I started digging into this, because it was like, as you suggest, okay, so these are really fascinating objects, but at the same time, they're being taken very seriously. How could that be? So one of the interesting things for me was to figure out, again, yeah, how could this be? And so this led me to think about a sort of the history of visual culture in the sciences. It's a really complex history when you start asking questions about how important is our visualization tools to sort of the history of the life sciences, and how essential is observation and experimentation and isolating the material world and being actually able to see it and make knowledge claims about it. So when you start digging into that history, what you sort of realize is that, you know, visualization takes is absolutely essential to the epistemic culture of the life sciences. And what I end up seeing in molecular animation is that it actually ends up filling in some really important gaps between the sort of priorities of the experimental life sciences on the one hand, and the priorities of systems biology and mathematical biology on the other hand. And what molecular animation is sort of poised to do and is able to do really well is sort of fill in these gaps where you can sort of relate parts to whole. And see relationships and formulate hypotheses and get a better sense of how it is that, a bunch of meaningless data points, essentially mathematics, could actually move. the first part of the book is really trying to trace that history.
That's very interesting in terms of the question of the scientific value of such a medium. But I think also another problematic point that your book touches upon is the problem of its efficiency, in a way, at filling that gap that you just mentioned. These images are almost too efficient, in a way, in filling this gap by providing a sense of a view from nowhere, in a way. Or maybe you can comment on that, because you make a lot of comments on the movement of the camera in these, or the camera, quote unquote, in these animations. And one term that comes back very often in your book is the term of consumption. The idea is that these images are being consumed. They're not simply being used, as you mentioned, as a medium in the sciences, as a tool in the lab, but they're being used to be consumed. And sometimes it is ambiguous who are consuming these images. Are the general audience consuming these images for them being fascinating and beautiful and interesting, or is it also the scientific community who's been consuming them in a different way? So I would like you maybe to clarify this idea that these images or animations, sorry, are being consumed, and where do you see the problem in that?
No, that's a really good question, because I think, look, the way, and I like the way that you're framing this in terms of the kind of view from nowhere, because look, the way in which these animations function, or the way in which they relate, if you like, parts to whole, is follows the same kind of logic that is pervasive in a sort of entertainment media and consumption or consumptive media culture more generally. And I think one of the things that it mandates is that that we see everything, that we visualize everything at all costs, and all of this is made available for my use. And I think it doesn't take much to see how the very same logic, this very same logic is kind of at work in how it is that scientists are using these images to perceive and fill in gaps. And it's this question of relating parts to whole where there are no questions, right? It becomes very ambiguous about what are the gaps in knowledge? What don't actually we know? And there's something very tempting and very alluring about an animated image that is able to bring time scales together. And on the one hand, allow us to feel our data in a new way, but at the same time, it sort of appeals to this this way in which we don't really want to be hesitant. We don't want to pause. We don't want gaps or interstitial spaces in our knowledge. And I think in terms of consumption, what I'm interested in thinking about is how actually scientists themselves have slowly become consumers in their own way. And so, I mean, we could talk about, you know, the sort of consumer economy and how, you know, within a sort of, and I do talk about this in the book, within the sort of neoliberal era of media consumption, consumers are also producers. And I sort of track that genealogy, but I think it's really important to see how there's a sort of similar logic at work in the molecular sciences. And part of this has to do with we're using the same technologies, but we're also in the sciences following some of the same norms. And some of the same norms from the entertainment culture are also transferring over into the way in which we think about and see our molecular world. And it's that convergence, that collision between the norms in entertainment culture and the norms in scientific culture that sort of are generating a new episteme. In other words, a new kind of epistemic culture where it's very difficult to tear apart science from entertainment. And it's that weird convergence that I'm really interested in. And I think that molecular animation it's that moment that allows us to see something when we kind of look back. I mean, one of the things that I didn't really sort of articulate in the book, but I would have liked to, is that, you know, it's that kind of moment when you look back in time, you're like, where did something change? and in molecular animation, I think about and I try to articulate in the book as one of those really essential moments.
This is quite interesting because it really puts in perspective, or at least it calls into question, just as you mentioned, the history of that collision between the entertainment world and science. We tend to usually think in terms of very hermetic boxes. There is the science on one side, there's the general public on the other end. And in the middle stands maybe what we call scientific communication, usually, and which includes a variety of medias and different actors that transit between the two groups. But we usually tend to think of them as remaining themselves, remaining safeguarding their integrity. And I think apart from this notion of consumption that you already commented on, you have been referring many times already during this interview about the notion of feeling the data. And I think this is also a very strange thing to say or to articulate, really, because especially when we think about these very complex form of sciences that require so many technological tools, we usually tend to think that the point is to safeguard ourselves from any sort of emotion or feelings toward the object in order to remain objective. And it seems like molecular animation is actually doing quite the opposite, or at least tending to create some sort of feeling toward these data and these molecules that are essentially invisible and not experienceable. And I think you comment a lot in your book on the different point of view that scientific actors have on these molecular animations. Some of them are a bit more skeptical about their value. Others see them, and I'm quoting here, as useful science fictions. So could you explain maybe where the points that here of contention lie in the case of the scientific value of those molecular animations? And where does the value of feeling the data maybe lie for some scientists?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think one of the things that's really difficult about molecular animation, and you're sort of hitting on it, is that they kind of they announce their artifice, and I think it's the fact that they are so, I mean, constructed, and they are, you know, these are not the kind of molecules that exist in the world. They are fictions in this sense, and I think that this is really, really difficult for a lot of scientists to kind of stomach, you know. It's like it's like admitting that science deals in fiction, and that and I think especially today, I mean, that's a PR nightmare to say that science is fundamentally about construction. It's about imagination. It's about fiction, and that those facts, quote unquote, that that we want to be as reliable as possible are constructed. And I think that, I think that scientists, any good working scientist who's a bench scientist, is perfectly aware that the world they're working in is a, you know, techniques or a technology for generating certain kinds of claims, that it is incredibly artificial. And I think that this isn't, I mean, this is part and parcel of doing science. You know, I think that there's a sort of fantasy that the kind of claims that circulate are referring to the world as if, you know, they themselves were not constructed under very, very specific conditions, right? And so I think that it's not that difficult for scientists to accept that they're working with artificial conditions, that the what it is that they're generating in the laboratory is very different from what's out there in the field, what's out there in quote unquote nature. And so I don't think that the real rub or the real difficulty has to do with artifice per se. I think it has to do with the fact that molecular animations blur so that they're so good at blurring what is just an artifact of the instruments we're using, and what it is we actually can say with some sort of reliability. I mean, even though that, you know, even though the when scientists are working, when molecular biologists are working in the lab, and these are incredibly, you know, these are, you know, they're working with technologies and they're artificial conditions. It's not the same as being in the environment. At the same time, they're working towards a kind of repeatability, a kind of reliability where they can have a sort of firm hold on the world given certain conditions. And I think what molecular animation does is to easily blend hypothetical things, things we don't know, fantasies, with things that are more or less agreed upon, even though they have been constructed under artificial conditions. And I think it's that sort of space of uncertainty or ambiguity that makes scientists really, really concerned and nervous. You know, and so I think this is one of the things that certain animators have taken very seriously, and which is why some of their animations are paying attention to what it is we can say and what it is we can say and we seem to know for, as it were, certain, and things that are more hypothetical, you know, and they do that aesthetically, right? I mean, there's more detail in a particular animation because we have more confirmation that this is actually how things seem to work. And then things are a little bit more cartoonish because we're not quite certain that this is what is, this is how this protein folds, if you like. But we're trying it out. This is a hypothesis, right? And I think it's in that space where the hypothetical works together with what it is that we can more or less say for certain, that the importance of feeling data becomes really important, right? The sort of contortions that we, I mean, I think somebody like Natasha, I'll just say somebody like Natasha Myers, who's an anthropologist, who wrote a beautiful book, I think back in 2014 or 15, called Rendering Life Molecular, does a lot of work on this. And she's talking more specifically about molecular modelers. And she does an amazing job to think, to do sort of an ethnography of their bodies and how it is that screens and bodies kind of go together to sort of make sense of data in order to sort of, well, you know, stitch together things that are in some ways fundamentally meaningless. And I think this is one of the most important things for molecular biologists is that there's this history of visualization that in the data intensive sciences, we kind of, a lot of scientists sort of forget about. And when they're trying to make claims about what it is they're doing, the appeal to visualization isn't particularly strong, but that's part of the history of the practice. That's part of the history of the molecular biosciences is visualization.
This, what's really striking here is how we could think of molecular animation as a new form of publication for molecular scientists in a way. And when you think about scientific publication, they're very strict rules on how, for example, a scientific article is being done. And you can see different categories of claims that are arranged in separate paragraphs, for example, that allows you to distinguish between the hypothetical claim, the factual claim, the conclusions, etc., the references. I mean, this is the way at least I'm comprehending your remark on molecular animation, kind of blending all these claims together. And it becomes extremely difficult and uncomfortable to translate that into a more traditional scientific discourse that has found its codes to distinguish between claims. Am I correct? Am I understanding correctly?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I think that there's also this. This has kind of been the work of science and technology studies and anthropology of science and, you know, some areas in the philosophy of science for decades now, trying to sort of, you know, look at what it is that scientists are claiming and what they say they're doing, and then what is it that they're actually doing behind the scenes, right? And then there's a kind of, you know, visualizing, if you like, the invisible in order to see these sorts of intersecting and overlapping histories, right? And I mean, that's one of the things this book is trying to do, is trying to think about the, you know, the intersection and the overlap between a kind of a science that is so in some sense visual. And on the other hand, its use of visualization technologies that come from other domains, right? But I think one of the things that this book is also trying to do is take seriously why it is that scientists would also have objections to what it is that, say, a philosopher or an anthropologist would say it is that they're doing, right? And I think this is one of the pushback I've actually received in this book is that, or for this book, is that in the early stages, there were folks basically saying that, don't we already know that science and entertainment is blurred? Don't we already know that you know, the history of visual culture overlaps with the history of cinema? And I want to say, yeah, we do. But at the same time, there is an important way in which we have to retract the resistance to what it is, the kinds of claims that scientists are making. And what's the problem with admitting, for example, that we're borrowing from the entertainment industry, right? And so what actually happens if we follow that history out and we actually track that relationship and we see what kind of knowledge practices emerge from that and what kind of claims are being made? And it becomes problematic.
I think it's the perfect, your remark is the perfect transition to my next question, because what happens when we follow that lead, right? When we don't just admit that there is a collusion between entertainment and cinema and science, but we actually follow, we ask questions about it and we try to dig a little deeper. And I think that's where your book also adds another dimension, obviously, to the discussion. And you can see all of that being, I would say, summarized in the title itself, Molecular Capture. And as you mentioned, capture has two meanings here. One, which is capturing just a moving image of the molecular world. And the second one refers more in the line of Foucault, which you cite in your book, refers to the process through which molecular world is actually made available, mobilized within a certain rationality of governance. So these are these two meaning, I think, to me, they kind of dictate the general progression of your book. And we've discussed mostly the first meaning so far, which is the first part of a first great sequence of your book. And then the second one focuses on the second meaning of it, which tends to, I think, try to connect the capture of the molecular world with problems coming more from gearing toward more the biopolitical questions that relate to it. And we already discussed a little bit about consumption and the entertainment industry, but your book talks a little bit more about the political and economic aspect of molecular animation. Do you mind commenting on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, let me just say from the get-go that the biological sciences in some fundamental sense are always already political. And I don't mean political simply by that they express some sort of political party's views or some style of politics that's, in the lowercase p, political. Although that may be the case, especially today. The biological sciences are fundamentally creating taxonomies, and to create taxonomies of living systems and to secure, protect, and maintain them in very specific ways. I mean, this is political. This is biopolitical in that sense. And I think one of the things, at least insofar as I'm concerned, is that what we need to be asking about is not whether biological sciences are political and have some sort of relation to political economics, is how they do and to what end. For me, the way I treat this in the book, molecular animation is a kind of major achievement of political rationality. And what I mean by that, or political rationality in the West, at least, and what I mean by that is that biology has, in some fundamental sense, the visualization technologies in biology and the modes of perception now overlap with those in the entertainment industry. And that kind of overlapping has not come all at once. And that's one of the things that I sort of trace in the second and third part of the book. Is that this has been a sort of slow and steady progression that we can track through, the history of liberal governance to neoliberal governance, to thinking about how it is biology becomes cinematized. And a discipline or a practice that is so invested in the visual does borrow in these very specific ways from visual culture. I mean, we see it. We see it early on. I mean, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century, with microcinematography and the use of the use of the cinematograph in order to sort of think about time-based processes and cellular processes, right? And then there was a sort of reaction that can be sort of traced. What's interesting is you can see the sort of reaction of the of biologists in the early 20th century and late 19th century that sort of mirrors what a lot of scientists are doing today when they see molecular animations, is that there's a sort of they think it's, you know, entertainment for the masses. There's no way that we could be mirroring the processes that are actually happening in the natural world on the screen, right? But what you actually realize when studying and looking at these histories is that, and this is to, you know, my debt to the work of Hannah Landecker actually comes out in this, in the third part of the book, is thinking about how it is that biological knowledge became temporal, right? They became time-based in a very specific way and sort of moved outside of the only spatial, the way in which knowledge was spatialized in that era. And it's sort of tracking this history and also thinking about the way that there are very specific regimes of visuality that come into play when you introduce these technologies. So it's not simply that these technologies are neutral. It's not we just simply introduce a new technology and, oh my God, we can see more. No, that our apparatuses of perception themselves are being trained. We are being home to see new things. And this also partakes in a wider sort of cultural sphere as well. And it's sort of this convergence of entertainment and biological knowledge production that I'm really trying to trace, you know, throughout the second and third parts of the book, that we really do begin to see how it is that the norms of scientific viewing and the norms of entertainment consumption not just influence each other, but actually become one and the same. And so what we have now is a sort of new episteme, or what I like to think of as a sort of biological entertainment episteme. And this has everything to do with the sort of progressive commodification of perception, where everything, including time-based cellular processes, are viewable, are in some fundamental sense consumable, and that itself produces value.
This is really fascinating, especially your last remark that entertainment and science, in terms of the kind of visual they produce, is not that they influence each other, that they become each other. As we were talking, I was thinking about a very short sequence, I think in the first Spider-Man movie, where Peter Parker just has gotten beaten by that spider, and you suddenly jump into a view of his genome and how the DNA is directly being altered and replaced by a sort of other sequence. And when I'm comparing these images to the kind of visualization that are being done in the molecular animations that you comment on, they appear extremely similar, analogous, at least in terms of the aesthetic of it and the point of view that the viewer is taking. So I think, I mean, to me, that's at least how I'm visualizing what you're saying here. And what's particularly interesting, I think, about your book, and what I really appreciated, is that coming to the end of it, I had a completely different sense of what you were talking about, because at first we very focused on the molecular animation themselves. And then we come to realize that, especially when we start talking about the biopolitical aspect of it, we come to realize that we're talking essentially about the elusiveness of life as both an object of inquiry and an object of political power, of control. And obviously the story of how humans and Western cultures in particular have been trying to deal with this elusiveness of life as an object of power or science is quite extensive. And your book tries to at least retrace some of the history that relates to molecular animation. But I and really, the allowed me to, arriving really at the postscript of your book, it allowed me to reread the entire book through that lens. And since life obviously always exceeds any solution we have at visualizing it, at framing it, and I think you already commented on that, what would you say molecular animation is missing of life? And if I wanted to be a little bit more controversial, I would say, what do you think molecular animation is hiding from life, despite its promise to deliver some sort of very immersive, comprehensive view of life's mechanisms?
Yeah, I like this idea of hiding. Let me say that I think one of the challenges with molecular animation is it too often doesn't allow things to hide. That one of the normative, I don't know if it might be too strong of a claim, but the sort of mandate within the sort of molecular visualization community to see everything, to see behind every corner, to visualize each and every mechanism, to not allow those mechanisms to hide is what molecular animation doesn't allow those mechanisms to hide. It reminds me of what Paul Virilio talks about in terms of ballistic perception, where Paul Virilio talks about the sort of the bomb's eye view of cinematic perception in the modern age, whereby we have to go in and immerse ourselves in absolutely everything and consume it. To answer your question very simply, what it's hiding, what molecular animation is hiding, is life's elusiveness. Life itself hides. It's and I think that it's a fascinating technology, and that's what we've talked about before, is that, you know, it's a technology that brings together cinema, computing, and painting, basically. And I think that's fascinating. And I think that there are tons of affordances of this technology but, you know, one of the troubles, I think, is that this tech lures us into thinking that we can fill in every unknown, and that we can fill in these spaces, these gaps, and these interstitial spaces. And I think biology itself is incredibly susceptible to this. From a kind of neo-Darwinian perspective, I mean, there is this need to mechanize all of every living system, to put it within one large causal network, and to understand how that causal network is put together. And I think molecular animation in some ways offers a crucial assist there, right? I mean, it allows us, it allows biologists to, you know, stitch together parts and whole. And that's exactly what neo-Darwinianism really wants us to do mechanistically.
So I think we're entering here a very interesting question, which you start to delve in a little bit at the end of your book, which is what would, let's say, an ethical biological molecular animation look like? What would a molecular animation that allows both for the stitching together of data, the possibility for biologists to feel some of their data, while at the same time accepting this sort of elusiveness of life, so allowing for a vision of life that is not just mechanized, what would it look like? And I think at the end of your book, you have a brief discussion of Jean-Pierre Levé's scientific cinema. It was mostly an avant-garde cinematographer and artist. So it's quite interesting that your book starts with very modern molecular animations and then ends with some images and the kind of visualization dating back from the 1920s and up to the 1960s, at least, or in the case of Jean-Paul Levé. So it's a strange, I would say, temporal progression in the book. So how would you maybe comment on that? What do you see in the scientific cinema of Jean-Paul Levé that maybe allows for new perspectives in the field of molecular animation?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the sort of temporal progression, because, you know, the way I think about it, I guess, and what the book kind of leaves you with is, in order to go forward, you need to go backward and backward to sort of forgotten histories. And it's through these sort of forgotten histories that we can understand that sort of different things could have emerged, right? What I like to think about is in terms of, I mean, a sort of speculative histories in the philosophy of science. What would that look like? And for molecular animation, I think it ends up in Jean-Paul Levé. At least that's one option. And the reason I say that is, I mean, it's part of actually a bigger project that I'm working on right now. But it does have to do with, I've written some about this. But it has to do with the way in which, when we think about cellular systems or molecular systems and cellular systems and wider environments that influence those systems, we don't really know how we can stitch these things together, right? We can model them, but probability distributions don't really get the job done, because actually when we're thinking about these kinds of causal networks, they're non-probabilistic. And I'm working with the computer scientist and turned kind of theoretical biologist, Giuseppe Longo, the Italian biologist who works in Paris. And we're working on some of this, and I'm writing a book actually right now on his work and the way in which he's thinking about the, we need different understandings of, or theoretical conceptions of living systems that are non-mechanistic, but that are also non-probabilistic, that move beyond sort of the complexity scientists or sciences, that sort of, it's a kind of complexity beyond complexity. Because we need to be thinking about systems that generate their own conditions for the future as they unfold. And what this means is that we can't actually pre-state We can't pre-state what a biological system, where it's going to go, what its developmental trajectory and evolutionary trajectory actually is, right? We can have a pretty good idea of the sort of how epigenetic inheritance systems work, but we can't actually repeat those. We can't know for sure and isolate them over and over again that this is how this mechanism works. And what that does is that opens up this really ambiguous space where there are massive blind spots. There are things that we don't know, and that there are uncomfortable things. And so how do we build theories around this? And my interest is thinking about, well, look at, biology has this rich history of being a visual science, and that we should, and it's not simply visualization. We don't simply just visualize what we already know, right? The visualization itself is an epistemic practice. It's epistemic media in that sense. And this is, so I guess you could say my critique of mainstream molecular animation is that it really doesn't allow for these blind spots. It doesn't allow us to see these interstitial spaces that are actually so important for the most sort of progressive and interesting theoretical biology that's happening right now. And strangely, it's Jean-Paul Levé, who is somebody who was working within a sort of, he was working on the fringes of both the avant-garde and, biological visualization technologies in the early 20th century, because he was neither really accepted, or he was accepted by neither one really. And it sort of, he was doing his kind of own thing. Everyone kind of liked him, but he never was officially a surrealist, because he didn't sort of abide by their principles and so forth. And he was a, biologist thought he was kind of strange, especially with all of his voiceovers and the mystery, and the sort of, he had this kind of intense interest in the movement of biological systems, but he, And even, you know, with this sort of voiceovers, you know, he's been critiqued for anthropomorphizing them. But it's interesting because those anthropomorphisms are really important because they're not an anthropocentrism, because they're always working against our sort of temptation to think that these things that he's filming are actually relatable. His voiceovers make it so that the strangeness, the mystery, the pause, the hesitation, that itself is always built into his cinema. And I think we need more of that. I think that's the kind of call that I'm making at the end of the book, is that, and that's what we don't have. And that's what sort of goes against and works against all the sort of, you know, the mandate that we, or that biologists have today, to sort of visualize everything at all cost.
This is really, really fascinating, because I could summarize it maybe by saying we're waiting for some sort of avant-garde cinema of molecular animation rather than the formula, the Hollywoodian formula of cinema that is currently being used in molecular animation. But thank you so much. I mean, you've already shared some of the projects you're currently working on, but I think to go back maybe to Jean-Pierre Levé, I think you mentioned at the end of your book that it would be a topic worthy of an entire book. Are you currently following that lead as well? Are you, if you would like, obviously, to share any of that work you may be carrying right now?
I'm not directly working on it. It's kind of on the back burner, although it does kind of inform a lot of indirectly a lot of the projects that I'm working on right now. I should say that I'm cashing out in smaller pieces, in a piece for an encyclopedia of animation right now. I'm thinking about Jean-Pierre Levé as a sort of biological animator and this being an alternative history, if you like. But, you know, most of the projects I'm working on right now actually are dealing with one project I'm dealing with, or I'm working on, which is a new book on governmentality and design. So it's really taking up that postscript where I try to reread the entire book that was just written and turned through the lens of design and a sort of new architectures of perception through governmentality. So that's one book that I'm working on. And then I'm working on another book on artificial intelligence and AI ecologies, but I will be using, to think through that, I will be using a lot of Alfred North Whitehead, who I talk a good deal about in the sort of middle sections of the book. But Penlevé, I mean, look at this sort of, these speculative histories of speculative histories in the philosophy of science and what Penlevé can do for visualization practices in the sciences. I think they're incredibly important, and I'm slowly trying to bring that out, but I do think it needs to be done slowly and carefully.
Of course. Well, thank you so much, Professor, for this interview. This was absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate your comments and your answers to my question. Thank you again so much.
Well, thank you for having me.